genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turning now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
My next guest looks at the events of 9/11/01 from a first-hand perspective of one Marine Lieutenant Colonel who happened to be in the White House on the day the tragedy occurred. Saturday, as you all know, marked the 9th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Nearly 3,000 Americans lost their lives as a result of those two attacks. While many Americans commemorated the anniversary, our next guest has vivid memories seared into his consciousness from that day. If you want to call in and talk to somebody who was there on the front lines during 9/11, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the county, 805-639-0008. Lieutenant Colonel Robert J. Darling retired from the U.S. Marine Corps in September of 2007 after more than 20 years of service. He has delivered numerous presentations, including as a guest lecturer on crisis leadership and counterterrorism at the FBI National Academy at Quantico and at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He is currently the Vice President of Zenitech LLC, a premier information and technology and logistics support service. He lives in Stafford, Virginia with his wife and his two sons. Welcome to the show, Colonel. How are you doing today?
It is great to be with you today. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it is our pleasure, first of all. And let me thank you for your service, not only during 9/11, but throughout your entire 20 years in the Marine Corps. Thank you very much from all of us for that.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thanks. All right. Now, let me ask you, on 9/11, what were your duties in the White House? I mean, why were you there on such an important, auspicious date in U.S. and even, in fact, in world history?
Well, my time in the Marine Corps, I was an attack helicopter pilot. I flew Cobras in the first Gulf War, then again in Somalia. I came back home in 94. They made me a Cobra flight instructor, then a recruiter. And in 1998, I put a package in, and I was selected to fly President Clinton around with Marine Helicopter Squadron 1, the shiny white tops they see take off and land on the south lawn of the White House.
Yes.
That was our squadron, HMX-1. And I had that distinct pleasure of flying the president around the world. We would actually go in advance of him. What some folks may not realize is everywhere the president travels throughout the world, he flies only in our helicopters, rides in only our limousines, hardened limousines, and talks only on our secure phones. So everywhere in the world, when he steps off Air Force One, this entire logistics package of Secret Service, doctors, Marines, and everybody else is there waiting for him so he can execute his political agenda.
Wow.
In October of 2000, I was asked to go up and be a part of the White House military office as a representative from this squadron, the Marine Helicopter Squadron One, and my job was to do logistics. I would help work with the president's staff, determine what trips were upcoming, and then coordinate with the Air Force to carry all the limousines, the helicopters, and phones all to those locations in advance of Air Force One.
Wow. Oh, that's incredible. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel retired Robert Darling, everybody. And believe it or not, Bob, we've got a call already. So let me just jump right to it. I know what she's going to ask you, but to set the stage here, you know, you've served. You are obviously there in the White House at the hot spot, and you were at the tip of the sword, as they say, as this was going down on 9/11. We've got a caller, Nanette. She wants to ask you a question about your thoughts of the mosque that they're contemplating building at Ground Zero of the World Trade Centers. Nanette, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Nanette. Thank you so much for being a loyal listener. Welcome to the show. What's your question for the Lieutenant Colonel?
Well, I'd like to have his opinion, because otherwise, you know, a lot of us out here are trying to decide whether to send money to the national, you know, for United States. I can't say it right now, but anyway, you know, to support not having it built there. So I'd like to have his opinion on what he thinks about it.
Well, the worst, and thanks for the question, Annette. It was the worst attack on American soil in our history. I think it was even a larger attack than Pearl Harbor. In my opinion, that's hallowed ground. It's sacred ground. Not only do we lose all those firefighters and civilians, nearly 3,000 Americans lost their lives. If anything, it could be a cemetery as far as I'm concerned. But when I raised my right hand to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, I was defending our, you know, constitutional rights. Do I believe they have a constitutional right to build a mosque? Sure I do. Do I believe it belongs anywhere near Ground Zero? Absolutely not.
Now, that's interesting. Nanette and Bob, both of you, I want you to hang in there for this question, which is a follow-on, because I did want to talk about this. You know, really, the mosque at the Ground Zero of 9/11, is this a national issue, or is this simply a New York issue? I mean, there are five or six other mosques that are being built in the United States as well, one right out here in California, in Temecula, as well. And so I have to ask you, you know, is this a national issue, or is this just a local issue that has gotten sort of polarized? What are your thoughts? Nanette, what do you think?
I think it's a national issue. I think all of us Americans need to have a decision in this.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. And Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Nanette. It is a national issue. I'm not convinced as a citizen of this great country whether that mosque is going to be used for peaceful purpose or hostile purpose. I think the onus is on them to prove to us that it's going to be used for all the right means and not be a house of planning, not be a house of terror. I don't think the onus is on Americans to accept the mosque for what it is. I think the onus is on the Muslims who want to build the mosque to prove to us, A, that it's there for peaceful means, and if they really believe that, then why does it have to be there in the first place? Move it somewhere else. I don't think it needs to be at Ground Zero.
All right, that's great. Nanette, thank you so much for the call. It was a great question.
Thank
I greatly
you.
Appreciate your listening to the show.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And bye-bye. Wow, that was cool. Now, so back to what your duties were at the White House. I'm sorry to bounce around like this, but you were really in charge of logistics there. I get it. And there are many, many logistics that have to happen whenever the president moves from one location to the next. So you were there the morning of the event. How did it go down? What do you recall happening that momentous morning?
Sure. The president, I moved him to Sarasota, Florida. I was responsible for that logistics. I was expecting Air Force One to bring him home early that afternoon, and my job would have been to clean up the hard cars, the helicopters, the phones, to get it all back home. After the two towers were hit, our focus in the office up there in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building adjacent to the West Wing was to stand by to get more relief supplies to New York. It was a FEMA asked for a White House designated mission to have the Air Force carry a bunch of relief supplies. We were the office that was going to coordinate that with the Department of Defense. When all of a sudden the low-flying airliner penetrated P-56, prohibited airspace over the White House, and a few minutes later we had an explosion and a fire over at the Pentagon, and it turned out to be American Airlines Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon, which changed our day and everybody else's day forever. The White House was soon evacuated at 9:45. Everybody was going to their rallying points to take, you know, accountability for who was present, who wasn't present. I grabbed my boss and said, wherever the president's going to go, he does not have his presidential package that I just described. Let me go down into the president's emergency operations center, the bunker under the White House, and let me do logistics. He said, great, we're evacuating. Grab the planning kit. Go on down the bunker. I'll catch up with you there later. As you can imagine, I walked outside the Eisenhower building. I had to pause at the top of the steps because the White House is a fortress, security on top of security. And as soon as I walked outside, I saw the gates to the north open, the gates to the south open, Secret Service with automatic weapons yelling on bullhorns, ladies, take off your heels and run for the exits. There's another plane inbound. It was just a surreal sight to see these professional staffers sprinting off the White House campus, you know, literally running for their very lives. I showed my credentials. I crossed the street there, West Executive Drive, got down into the bunker. I saw the vice president's military aide, a friend of mine. I said, Tom, I'll stay out of your way. I'm here to do logistics. He said, Bob, forget logistics. I need you to answer the phones. They're ringing off the hook.
Wow. We're talking to Bob Darling, everybody, retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Marine Corps, a man that was there in the White House as 9/11 was happening. So here you are. You get the warning that there's an inbound flight. Of course, that was United Flight 93, as I recall. What happened next? Because at that point, you probably are having to make some decisions. Do we let that bird stay in the air, or do we have to shoot that down to protect the Capitol? What was going on then?
Okay, inside my book, I really do describe the historic account that what happened, but let me share it with all your listeners today. I pick up, this is about 9:52 now, I pick up the phone call. It happens to be a direct line to the White House Situation Room in the West Wing. My first phone call, he says, we have another hijacked plane 16 miles south of Pittsburgh, inbound Washington, D.C. I said, well, okay, you're going to have to hold on. I turned to my right to pass that information to the military aide, the vice president's military aide, and then, lo and behold, Vice President Cheney is a foot away from me going, Major, what do you got? Mr. Vice President, 16 miles south of Pittsburgh, inbound Washington, D.C. Now, everyone's coming into the bunker. I saw Dr. Rice, her deputy, Lynn Cheney, Secretary Mineta of Transportation. Everybody's coming in. They're coming over to my phone, my area. And the first person the Vice President talks to is Rick from the FAA Herndon Command Center in Herndon, Virginia. He said, Rick, can you confirm we have another hijacked plane somewhere south of Pittsburgh, inbound Washington, D.C.? Stand by, stand by. We're checking. Mr. Vice President, the plane's not talking. It's not squawking. It's transponder code. It's way off course. That's a hijacked aircraft. Don Rumsfeld, are you up? He's looking for Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. He was not up. He was outside actually helping with the wounded over at the Pentagon when they came back and said, this is the National Military Command Center. How can we help you, sir? And right away, I'm still holding on to the receiver, and the vice president said, I want two F-15s. I want them at Otis Air National Guard Base. Let me know when they're airborne. Stand by to shoot this aircraft down.
Amazing. I mean, you've got me on the edge of my seat. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel retired Robert Darling of the United States Marine Corps, author of the book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01, The White House. Bob, we're going to have to take a break, believe it or not, for some commercials. But when we come back, I want to continue with this story that you yourself described as surreal. That's our theme for today's show, is surreal. So when we come back, I want to pick up the story with Flight 93 inbound towards the White House. And we'll come back after this short break.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with the Billy the Brain here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. And I got to tell you, today's theme is surreal. The stories that we're hearing right now have the hairs on my arms standing at full attention. Of course, that's appropriate because we're talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert Darling. He was in the White House the day that 9/11 happened. He's also the author of the new book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01, The White House. And boy, this is a hair-raising situation that you're describing, Bob, because here you've got United Flights 93 inbound towards Washington. You don't know if it's en route to the White House, which in fact it was, and you've just scrambled some Reserve Air Corps to intercept it. What was going on in your mind? What was happening inside the bunker at this time?
You know, right when Vice President Cheney ordered the military into action like that, I had to just pause for a second and stare at him, and I said, wow, this is not an ordinary politician. I was fully expecting him to ask more questions. How fast? How far? Do we think they're going to divert? Are they still heading to Washington, D.C.? But he was so decisive. He was cool under pressure. He was calm. And then I realized that this is not an inexperienced individual by any sense of the word. He was a congressman, a White House chief of staff, a secretary of defense, and now Vice President of the United States. It may sound callous, but he saw Flight 93 for what it really was. At the point the terrorists overtook that aircraft, it was really not a peaceful commercial airliner anymore. It was the equivalent of a 150-ton Tomahawk cruise missile heading for a target in Washington, D.C., looking to kill scores of Americans on the ground. So to pick the story up, we had F-15s reported supersonic over Long Island, New York. They were 5 minutes out, weapons free to engage. They were cleared hot to engage Flight 93. Within about 4 or 5 minutes, it came over the SATCOM radios, aircraft down, 68 miles south of Pittsburgh, no survivors. For a brief moment in time, all the air was sucked out of the bunker. Everyone was just dead silent. All eyes were on the vice president. He paused for a moment, he took a deep breath, and then he turned and walked right over to me and said, for the congressional inquiry, state your full name. I said, Mr. Vice President, it's Robert Joseph Darling. He said, from Major Robert Joseph Darling to the Vice President to the National Military Command Center, we just shot that plane down. I really need to talk to the President of the United States. And then everybody was scrambling, trying to reach President Bush on Air Force One so the Vice President and the President could talk about these events. And sure enough, about 1 minute later, all the radios came to life that the F-15s never fired. Flight 93 was on the ground in Shanksville when they got there. It was the heroes. It was Scott Beamer and the other passengers who talked to their loved ones who realized this plane wasn't diverting. This plane was on a suicide mission. They took on the terrorists. They wrestled the aircraft back. Unfortunately, in so doing, they lost their lives. But as far as we're all concerned, they won the first battle against radical extremism and fanaticism right there over Shanksville. And the vice president then said to all of us quietly in the back there, however that plane came down, it'll be remembered as a plane full of heroes instead of a plane full of victims.
No, oh, very well said. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel retired Robert Darling of the United States Marine Corps, author of the book 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01, The White House. Boy, you can tell a story. I mean, that is just riveting the way that you describe it. I have two quick questions for you. First of all, President is airborne, and he's on his way to Sarasota, Florida, which is as it should be. But why was the Vice President still in the White House, and why was he in harm's way?
The Vice President was in the White House because he didn't have a political agenda to do on September 11th. Dr. Rice was also there. The First Lady was in and around Washington, D.C. The Secretary of Defense was in the Pentagon and other principals. It was President Bush who went down Monday afternoon to Sarasota. He was going to be talking at the Emma E. Booker Elementary School that morning, which he was.
Which he did.
And then he was going to come, and he was going to come back to Washington early that afternoon.
Gotcha.
As far as being in danger, the Vice President was in no danger until that aircraft, and I have to clarify this for your listeners, too, the aircraft that broke that actually overflew the White House turned out not to be American Airlines Flight 77, the same one that hit the Pentagon. It was actually an Air Force E-4B, a command and control aircraft that was parked just to the east of Washington, and for whatever reason, when it was departing, it inadvertently came too close to the White House. That's what caused the Vice President to get yanked out of his seat by the Secret Service and brought down to the PEOC, the Emergency Operations Center. It was, in fact, not Flight 77. It was just an unbelievable coincidence that those two heavy-lift aircraft were so close to each other at that time.
That's amazing. We're talking to Bob Darling, everybody, retired Lieutenant Colonel of the Marine Corps. And, Bob, your book is fascinating, but I'm going to come back to something here. 9/11 was by far the worst terrorist attack that we've ever had, but it was by no means the only one that we've had in the last decade. I mean, just to recap a couple of them, there was Major Nadal Malik Hassan at Fort Hood. There was Omar Farouk, and I can't even pronounce his last name, who was turned out to be what we now call the underwear bomber. Faisal Shahad, who was the car bomber in New York City's Times Square. And our own Richard Reed, who was the shoe bomber. So my question to you is, are we winning the war on terrorism?
It's a great question. It's a complicated answer, but I'll give you the bottom line is this. The reason why the United States has been so successful over the last 9 years and not suffered another terrorist attack is not because our enemies are giving up, not because they're not trying, it's not because they're not resourceful and very intelligent. It's because our military is forward based, our CIA and our FBI and our NSA and all our intelligence agencies are working very closely together with the Department of Homeland Security, and we are thwarting all of their attempts to date to bring harm and terror into either our aircraft or our cities. Those are the true heroes of today. If it wasn't for what they're doing 24/7 for us, these terrorists would have been successful to date, but they just haven't been because of these dedicated individuals, men and women, who are keeping us safe.
Well said, well said, and a big shout-out to those men and women as well. All right, another question for you, same line of thinking along the political front, and that is President Barack Obama considers his June 2009 speech in Cairo, Egypt, as one of the three most important things he's done to combat terrorism. As you know, in that speech, he attempted to transform Muslim opinion towards the United States to much more favorable opinion than we had under President George Bush. Is President Obama doing enough to combat terrorism and keep our country safe?
Well, I'm talking as a regular American.
You're talking as a citizen, yes.
As a citizen. I'm not on the inside anymore. I don't see the operations that are taking place. But I know that under President Obama, our military is funded, our first responders are funded, our military is deployed, we haven't suffered another terrorist attack. I don't think it's fair to really give him undue praise or undue criticism at this point, other than to what I see, and I think he's obviously concerned about terrorism, and I believe he, as President of the United States, he's doing what he can to keep us safe.
Now, there's a very political answer for a man who's been inside of the White House. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Darling of the USMC, retired. He's also the author of a fascinating, absolutely riveting book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01 at the White House. And so now I'm going to come back to you, Bob, if I can, please. And we're going to look at you. Why did you write the story, and what do you want readers to get out of reading your book?
Yeah, thanks for asking me that question. I wrote this story because, obviously, from that day forward, it was always on my mind. I really think America needs to know what happened at the highest levels of our government. I was really impressed with the crisis leadership ability of Vice President Cheney. I think President Bush couldn't have had a better right-hand man that day in the White House, leaning forward, who was so knowledgeable, and they were willing to make unprecedented leadership decisions really on behalf of all Americans. It got down to the point where we were going to take American lives to save scores of other American lives. That type of courageous decision-making just doesn't come, you know, around every day. And I will say, even President Bush, when he was on Air Force One, we had the second tower down in Manhattan. Our best assessment at the time was that we had 40,000 dead Americans up there at Ground Zero. And telling your commander-in-chief and the President of the United States that he's got 40,000 dead, it was just an extremely emotional time for him. He paused for a second. He came back to the vice president and he said, "What is FEMA saying about New York? We don't know. We don't have a FEMA report yet. What are the hospitals saying about wounded? What's Mayor Giuliani saying? What are we doing right now for the people of New York?" And nobody had a very good answer for the commander-in-chief, the President of the United States. And the vice president literally reached down, took him off the speaker box so they could talk privately. But you felt the emotional, the weight of the attack on the leader of the free world.
Boy, this is an incredible story, an inside glimpse of what was going on that very tragic day back on September 11th, 01. 24 hours inside the president's bunker, 9/11/01 at the White House. Bob, follow-on question to the one I just asked you, and this is a little bit more complex. What did you get out of writing the book?
I got a sense of relief. I tell you, the reason why I wanted to write the book is I wanted my two sons, who are 7 and 4 at the time, and now they're 16 and 13, and I wanted them to know that their dad played an integral part in the defense of America on 9/11. I wanted them to have a historical record of my service in the Marine Corps, and that was my motivation, really, for getting this on paper. And now what I want is I want us never to grow complacent just because our first responders and our military are doing such a great job. I don't want anybody to think that our enemies aren't still trying to hurt us. I want everybody to remain vigilant. I want us never to forget, and I want us to know that our leaders that day were really impressive people who love America, who did the best they could with the information they had.
Great. We're talking to Bob Darling, everybody, retired Lieutenant Colonel from the United States Marine Corps, happened to be inside of the White House the day that the terrorists struck the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. Now, Bob, since then, you have retired from the Marine Corps back in 2007. What have you been doing since then, of course, besides writing your book?
Well, I took a job with a first biometrics company initially right out of the Marine Corps. They sell the finger, face, palm, iris, all those biometric machines that the U.S. Army was using to identify folks overseas. And then during my second year, I'm a partner now in this small IT service management company called Zenetics, and we do government contracting as well. We support the DOD and other federal agencies with IT-type services.
Gotcha. We're talking to Bob Darling, everybody. And Bob, one of the things that impressed me about your book were some of the endorsements that you have. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani endorsed your book, and he wrote this on it. "It reminds us," meaning the readers, "that this is not yet a part of our history, but it is still a present and ongoing threat." How would you assess Mayor Giuliani's comments?
Well, I thought it was spot on, and I made sure that his comment was right there up top. I couldn't agree more with him. He's someone who's still, even though he's not the mayor anymore, he's still very much involved in New York, and he's still concerned, greatly concerned about today, and having his endorsement just meant the world to me.
Oh, I imagine that it did. So you are of the opinion that the war on terror is still on and we need to be vigilant.
It is going to go on for, you know, decades to come, as sad as that may sound to some of your listeners, but this is now a struggle between good and evil and freedom and having no freedom, and we're not going to give that up ever. So you can count on this struggle lasting quite some time.
Amazing. Now, let me ask you, Bob, how did you spend this anniversary of 9/11 on Saturday? Maybe you were doing radio interviews like this one, but how did you spend it to commemorate the event?
I was the guest speaker at the Marine Corps National Museum here at Quantico, Virginia. We had 130 guests in attendance. We were sold out, and they let me talk for an hour on the contents of the book and what September 11th means to me as far as, democracy reigning over tyranny and oppression once again. I was a guest lecturer, and it was just a real privilege and a very special place for me, the Marine Corps Museum, to give this lecture.
Oh, I can imagine being a former, well, you're never a former Marine, being a retired Marine yourself, I can understand that. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Darling, everybody, his book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker. Let me ask you this. If somebody wanted to learn more about it or read about the book, where could they find the book or where could they get more information, Bob?
The book is available at Borders.com, BarnesandNobles.com, iUniverse.com. You can walk into any brick and mortar and say, I want, Darling's book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, and have them order it for you.
Okay, that's great. And what about your website? Where would you direct them if they wanted to learn more about you?
24HoursInsideThePresidentsBunker.com, and that's the number 24.
The number 24. Give that to us again, the number 24, HoursInsideThePresidentsBunker.com.
InsideThePresidentsBunker.com.
InsideThePresidentsBunker.com. That's great. Well, Bob, what are the lessons learned after 9/11? What are the most important takeaways that we as American citizens need to keep in top of mind as we move forward?
Oh, you have to remember that there's thousands of Americans out there on the front lines. The military has got over 150,000 deployed around the world. We're in many countries where CNN isn't. We're fighting to defend this country in places like Yemen and the Philippines and the Horn of Africa, as well as the Middle East. You need to honor those folks. Remember they're out there. You need to thank a firefighter every chance you get. And I just never want you to forget that we're going to be at war. We're at war, and we will be at war for some time to come. And we just stay vigilant. Just do your part. Keep your eyes and ears open, and do everything you can to keep America safe.
That's great. We've been talking to Lieutenant Colonel Robert Darling of the United States Marine Corps. He's now retired. Wrote the fascinating book, 24 Hours Inside the President's Bunker, 9/11/01 at the White House. Bob, I mean, we have to remind ourselves that you are doing a great service to this country as well by writing this book, giving us a perspective that the official reports just don't have to give. So thank you very much, not only for your service in the Marine Corps and during this crisis, but also for writing this book. We'll talk to you down the road.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was great to be with you today.
Thank you so much. Wow. What a moving, moving interview that was. We talked to Robert Darling of the United States Marine Corps. If you missed all or part of that interview, you can hear that interview on my website, brainstormingonline.com. That's brainstormingonline.com. That brings us to the end of another show. You've been listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ.